Well, good morning. Welcome back to Dining Around. Well, as I mentioned, we talked a little bit about Julia Child earlier and the whole Julia and Julia and the beginnings of blogs and websites and all the rest of it a couple of years ago, and how important it is to sort of be in a situation where you're on the go, looking at things, hanging out online, and then learning how to make things, learning how to participate in things, and learning more. We all like to go search things out online, but we don't always find sort of how to do the recipe that we want to do. We don't actually get the background information. And sometimes you just don't have time to go and buy a cookbook. And other times you want something absolutely specific that goes along with your interest or the holiday that's coming up or the weekend that's coming along. And I think that this is why when you're searching around, you find these little gems of things going on. It's important to celebrate them. It's important to participate in them. And I have Tori Avey. Tori Avey here. She is the Shiksa in the kitchen. She's a food blogger. She's a writer. She's a recipe developer. She does all sorts of interesting things. Of course, she has a great note right now online about 5 Labor Day dishes, things that you can make at home. And she's going to, well, she's here in front of me right now. So why don't I welcome her? Tori, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks so much for being here today. I was really interested and excited by your blog, by the information that you have on your blog. I was thinking back to my own sort of growing up childhood when we do holidays and holiday events, what my mom would make, what we would make in the kitchen. And I know that with our own sort of celebrating Christmas and celebrating New Year's and celebrating Easter, we had those dishes and those family traditions. But I don't really know a lot about other family traditions other than what my friends expose me to. So I think that the Shiksa in the kitchen is a very interesting thing for me, of course, because Rosh Hashanah is coming up.
Really a lot of what I do on both the Shiksa in the kitchen and mm-hmm. on my other blog, The History Kitchen, mm-hmm. is really an exploration of the roots of food and family food stories, family food history, because I feel like food is something that really connects all of us. I mean, mm-hmm. we all eat. There's nobody who doesn't eat, and pretty True. Much everybody I know loves to eat. Right. So it's something that really connects us. And there's a really visceral connection to what we've eaten in our childhood and mm-hmm. Memories associated with that. So, yeah, in terms of the holidays in particular, there's a really kind of a deep seated connection into what we were eating then and the things that we pass along through the generations. Mm-hmm. So right now it's Rosh Hashanah on the site. Mm-hmm. We're kind of starting to feature some Rosh Hashanah recipes next week. Mm-hmm. My site started as an exploration of Jewish cuisine. And so, you know, I delve into all areas of food history, but whenever the Jewish holidays come around, I really try to put a focus on it because there's such a rich cultural food history of the mm-hmm. Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I was fortunate to go to a Passover Seder at some friend's house, and I've been to a couple of them over time, and the way each of them celebrated it was just a little bit different, even though the breadth and the scope was the same. So their own families had, even though there were traditions, their own sort of small bent on those traditions. And of course, part of each of those traditions was being very welcoming of lots of people. This sort of larger, is Rosh Hashanah, is it a larger holiday? Is it a holiday that includes lots of people?
It does. It's a celebration of the Jewish New Year. And so there are some really beautiful food traditions associated with the holiday. We're always talking about having a sweet New Year. We want to mm-hmm. wish ourselves, you know, hope for the best in the New Year. And so we tend to feature lots of sweet foods and mm-hmm. symbolic foods that really, you know, encapsulate how we want our New Year to go. So one of the things that I'm doing a lot right now on the site is pomegranates are a very traditional food mm-hmm. For Rosh Hashanah.
They're a nightmare, I'm sorry. I mean, pomegranates are delicious.
Yeah.
And I love Palm Wonderful.
Yeah.
But the whole, like, on my fingers, on the floor.
Believe it or not, it's not as difficult as you think. There's actually a very easy way to seed a pomegranate and to juice it. You can actually find it on my website. It's on the homepage right now if you mm-hmm. go, how to seed and juice a pomegranate. You actually submerge it underwater and break it apart. And the pith, the white stuff that's in there.
It's sort of bitter.
Yeah, it rises to the top and all the seeds go to the bottom. So it's actually very simple to seed a pomegranate and then you just scoop out the pith and drain it.
And you don't end up with a bloody red cutting board.
Not at all. Yeah, it's actually a lot simpler than people think.
Well, I noticed on your website, you mentioned that, of course, that the that you have the pomegranates on the website or how to seed a pomegranate. You do have step-by-step and photographs and these sorts of things. And I find that that's very interesting. And I'm sure that's why the IACP voted it the best The best.
Oh, it was, yeah, the People's Choice
People's
Award,
Choice
actually.
Awards.
Yeah, for the best culinary website, which was a huge honor. I mean, it just, it blows my mind what's been happening with the site over the past year and how people out there are connecting to it. It just, it's a real blessing. And I just, you know, I look at all of my readers as my friends. I really do. I mean, there's a community that's really building around the site. And it's just such a gratifying thing to see that people are getting happiness out of the recipes and the stories and the history.
So before I ask you a little bit more about the history, portion of the website, but I wanted to know more about the Rosh Hashanah pomegranates. What sort of dishes do people make on Rosh Hashanah?
Well, you know, there are a lot of traditional dishes. Every family is a little bit different in terms of what they serve, but there are some kind of general things that every family likes to serve. Honey cake is one that's very popular, particularly amongst Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe. And one of the recipes that's been really popular on my site is an apple honey cake and apple honey cupcakes. Because, as I said, apples and honey, the sweet new year, you know, people dip apples and honey at the Rosh Hashanah meals. And so I combined those two into a cake. So I took the honey cake tradition and I added the apples to it. And that's, that's a really popular recipe on the site. But brisket is a traditional food for Rosh Hashanah. A lot of families, even though it's more of a Passover food, they eat matzo ball soup just because it's a holiday thing and it's, you know, very comforting and warm.
Everybody getting together.
Yeah, exactly. Leeks in Sephardic tradition, there's a historical connection to leeks. So some families make leek patties. They're called keftas de prasa. There's all kinds of great dishes. And it really depends on where your family comes from, your ancestry, where your grandparents grew up. That really kind of influences what you eat at your Rosh Hashanah meal.
So those sorts of moments. I know that growing up in the growing up Catholic in Niagara, Canada, we had different things that we would do, and then we would find out later on from other families the sort of, what do you mean you're having a ham? We normally have roast beef. Or what do you mean you have roast beef? We normally have a turkey.
Right.
Those sorts of things. And I know that sounds kind of mundane, but when you're cooking for 14, 18 people, having that centerpiece of the meat and then having all of the different side dishes, and then you see these American traditions, of course, with Thanksgiving, where they have so many different, you know, I like my potatoes this way and I like my potatoes that way. I love that because it's that, like, everybody has their only personal connection to it.
Yeah, it's their unique signature on the meal. And I think, you know, over the past generation, a lot of families got away from the home-cooked meal. You know, we all got so busy. Life got so fast over the past, you know, few decades. And so now I think people are really starting to reconnect with home cooking and, you know, making meals at home, which I think is why food blogs are becoming so popular, because the first place people look when they want to find a specific dish is Google. You know, they go online and they search it. And what's great about food blogging is that people can make personal connections with the people behind the food. So when I post a recipe, people know I've tested it many times and that I don't post anything that I don't truly love, you know. So people are kind of making new traditions now. You know, a lot of families are going to cook when maybe their mothers didn't cook as much. Now they're going and they're really, they're discovering the dishes that they're going to pass on to their kids and grandkids. And it's such a wonderful feeling.
Well, and if you're not cooking as often, you really do want to make sure that you know where to get the best ingredients, or what things perhaps your grandmother or your mother made, used, or your parents used, or that kind of thing, and getting those pieces of advice, setting it up in advance, getting your pantry together, those things, which when a big holiday approaches, it's sort of daunting. You're like, oh my gosh, I have 14 people coming over. What am I going to do? I don't even have enough plates for them.
Yes.
But that, finding that or getting that together. Well, I'm talking with Tori Avey. Tori Avey, of course, has two websites. One is theshiksa.com and the other is the
History Kitchen.
History Kitchen, I apologize, is the History Kitchen. And we're going to talk more with Tori about history and stuff. Just ahead.
You're listening to Dining Around on News Talk 910.
Hey, welcome back to Dining Around. I'm Joel Riddell. I have Tori Avey here in studio with me. She's theshiksa.com and she's also thehistorykitchen.com. We're talking a little bit about the history of food. We're talking a little bit about dishes that she would serve at Rosh Hashanah and all of those other things. And of course, the starting of your blog as well, and how fun and how popular it has become. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about history in the kitchen, because I noticed on the website you talked a little bit about Hearst Castle down on the Central Coast and your trip. So how did you decide to sort of to discover those History in the Kitchen moments?
Well, I grew up in, with Hearst Castle, I grew up in San Luis Obispo, California.
Well, there you are.
Yeah, I grew up on the Central Coast. I'm a local. Mm-hmm. And I went there when I was a kid, and I remember looking at the dining room and being so in awe of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's beautiful. It's a castle, you mm-hmm. know, and it was so regal. And when I started the History Kitchen, which is really a deeper exploration of the food history, all types of food history, not mm-hmm. just Jewish food, I wanted to go to Hearst Castle and rediscover mm-hmm. kind of, you know, what the food culture there was about. Mm-hmm. It's somewhat recent, the 20s and 30s, you know, but there's a cookbook that actually has some of Hearst's family recipes in it. Mm-hmm. And they know a lot about what was served there. There are lots of menus still in existence from, mm-hmm. you know, when Hearst would have his guests there. So I just found it a fascinating topic.
Mm-hmm. Now, do they have, with Hearst Castle, I mean, they have large grounds and they probably have gardens and all of the rest of it. Mm-hmm. So it would be sort of farm to table even then.
Yeah, it's really cool. They pretty much grew and raised all of their food right there. I mean, there was not too much around back then. You know, there wasn't really much of a community nearby. So, mm-hmm. yeah, all of the meat was butchered there. And in fact, Hearst Ranch is now a big beef producer. A lot of their beef is sold to Whole Foods. It's all grass-fed, grass-finished beef.
And, of course, they have such a big property there as well, and mm-hmm. managing the property. I mean, that would go a really long way in order to pay for the property management as well. Listen to me talking about business.
It's actually a California State Park now. So,
oh.
Yeah, and they have over 1 million visitors a year. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's a fantastic place, and I totally recommend going if you're passing through the area. You should actually book a tour ahead of time because they mm-hmm. tend to book up pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, not just locals go there.
Oh,
it's
no.
Big, it's
oh,
a
yeah.
big destination
no,
for
yeah,
everybody.
Lots of tour buses come. Yeah, it's a mm-hmm. fantastic tour. Really mm-hmm. fun.
So is that how you got your start in the History in the Kitchen? You sort of, you grew up in San Luis Obispo and said, I'm interested in these sorts of things.
No, not actually. I started the food blog. And, you know, I've always been interested in history since mm-hmm. I was a kid. I my grandparents really got me into it. My grandma and my grandpa were both very into history and culture. And I would spend almost every other weekend at their house growing up. And my grandfather in particular was like a walking encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. He knew everything about everything when it came to history. Mm-hmm. And so when I would go there, you know, we'd sit down and we'd watch movies like Ben-Hur and Cleopatra. Mm-hmm. And he would tell me the true stories behind these people, these legends. Mm-hmm. And he would bring out his atlas and show me the map of where everything was. And so and I was a really nerdy kid, so mm-hmm. I was totally into it.
Right.
I loved it. So that was really the history thing was deeply ingrained in me from childhood. But it wasn't until I started the food blog and I really started kind of putting the two together. Mm-hmm. I kind of started teaching myself to cook with vintage cookbooks. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to know kind of how to make a dish from scratch the old-fashioned way. That was just the way I wanted to learn. And so it all kind of came together when I started the blog. There was like this synthesis of all of these energies coming together. And now every dish I do, I really go into what is the story behind this dish mm-hmm. because everything has a story.
Right.
I mean, if you look hard enough, there every ingredient has a story. Every dish has a story. Mm-hmm. And family stories in particular are very interesting. To me.
What was the sort of the first blog posting that you did as far as History in the Kitchen, finding out? I mean, what was the most interesting or at least that moment that you said, this is what I need to know about?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure what the first one. I started it pretty early when I was doing the blog, looking into the historical roots. I will say that that in terms of the history thing and the family history thing, mm-hmm. I did an incredible blog, an incredible story about a guy named Michael who is a Holocaust survivor. And mm-hmm. I went and I met him, and I didn't realize he was a Holocaust survivor when I sat down to meet him. I sat down with him because he was a chef at Jerry's Deli for many years, and he was living in, you know, this community. And my friend who helps out at the community said, you should meet him. He's a chef. Maybe he has an interesting story. I said, great, because I love food stories
right.
and people's food stories. So I went to meet him and I sat down with him, and he started telling me about how he survived Auschwitz at 13 years old.
My gosh.
And I had no idea. And I talked to him for about 3 hours about his story and how he eventually found his way into a career as a chef. Mm-hmm. But his story is really, really incredible. And at the end of it, I said, you know, how come my friend didn't know that you were a survivor? He said, well, nobody ever asks me my story. You know, so it's just, you know, there are stories there to be had. And mm-hmm. it's just, you know, and all of it comes back to, you know, what is our family food story? What is our family history?
Mm-hmm.
It's also interesting to me.
I think it's fascinating. And I love the concept of, I mean, if you think about it from a professional chef's standpoint, there you are, you're in a kitchen of a restaurant and you have to put out so many meals and you do have to pay attention to that. And sometimes they have the special dinners that have to do with special occasions, and that's very exciting. But oftentimes the menu is much larger than just what is going to be on the center of the plate or what is going to be on the plate. Mm-hmm. There's a whole concept that goes around it and all the rest of it. But if you're a home cook or if you're an explorer, like you seem to be, you can take one thing and spend a little bit more time on it and then even say, I'm not as interesting as I thought I was, and go on to something. I don't know. I mean, that's, when I was on your blog, I saw the Rosa Parks pancakes, and I totally gravitated toward that. I'm like, I love pancakes, love peanut butter, and this is very interesting to me that you would even find something like that, gleaning moments of history.
Yeah, with the Rosa Parks pancakes, you know, they have her actual recipe handwritten on an envelope, and she probably just scribbled it one day next to her telephone. You know, maybe she was on the phone with somebody, and they were, but to think that she made that recipe at one point, and that we can taste that flavor that she was tasting, that it just really connects you to the past. I just did a piece on the history of the peach melba dessert. And, you know, peach melba is on menus all over this country. It's one of the most popular peach desserts, particularly at this time of year. It's very seasonal. And I didn't realize there was such a story behind it, but somebody told me there was a connection to an opera star. And so I started looking into it, and it's unbelievable. You know, this opera star from Australia, Nellie Melba, she was eating in Escoffier's restaurants in London at the time, and he created the dish in honor of her. And so this dish that we're eating all these years later really goes back to a friendship between a very famous chef and an opera singer.
And it's a Melba.
And it's a Melba.
We're talking Melbas with Tori Avey. We're going to talk more with Tori, and we'll do that just ahead.
You're listening to Dining Around on News Talk 910 and online at newstalk910.com.
Welcome back to Dining Around. I'm Joel Riddell here on September the 1st. This, of course, is In the Studio Conversation with Tori Avey. Tori Avey is the Shiksa.com and the HistoryKitchen.com, IACP People's Choice Award-winning blogs. And we were talking a little bit about what goes on in the blog, the stories that you can find there. And, of course, do visit the blog because there are recipes. There are step-by-step production recipes with photographs. So, like with the Rosa Parks recipe for the pancakes, there is the recipe itself for the pancake, and then there are photos of what those different pancake steps will look like. And that's important.
Well, yeah, I did that because, you know, when I was learning to cook, there were times when I would get to a certain step in a recipe and be like, I hope it's supposed to look like this because I don't really know, you know? So I thought it would be helpful for people, and it really has been, especially for newer cooks, to be able to see each step of the way what the dish should be looking like.
And then the different options with your pomegranate, to option A, option B, don't forget the water, don't forget the pomegranate because you're going to need that. That's important.
Yeah, exactly.
Those sorts of things.
Yeah, it keeps you on track.
And then as part of the blog, you also have the Shiksa, you also have the pantry, which is an online, an e-store.
The market.
The market.
Yeah, the Shiksa market. It's something I just launched a couple of weeks ago. I'm really proud of it. It's taken a lot of time to put together. It's you know, I started very organically. I had a lot of readers asking me, you know, what type of olive oil do you use? Or what's your favorite, you know, type of pan to make this dish? And at a certain point, I was getting so many of those requests that I thought, why don't I put them together in a market online so that if people are having trouble finding something in their local community, there's a resource for them to go and get those products. So
what kind of olive oil do you use?
I actually use Halutza organic olive oil, and it's an import from Israel. It's an award-winning olive oil. It's fantastic. I highly recommend it. That is on my on the market. And I also have a lot of really interesting, a lot of, you know, imports from all over the world, but in particular from Israel. I have some this Tishbe jams that are, Tishbe is a winery in Israel, a kosher winery, and their jams integrate some of their wines into the jam. So there's a Merlot jam, this is a strawberry champagne jam, and so really interesting flavors. I've also got some gluten-free products. I have a lot of gluten-free readers. I actually have a lot of different readers from different dietary needs and concerns because I try to make a point of whenever there's a recipe, I try to post if there's a gluten-free way to do it. I post the modification or, you know, if there's a vegetarian way to make something, I'll...
Well, and it's interesting you say that because it's not always the individual who's cooking that is.
Yeah.
If you have a dinner party for 12 people, invariably there's going to be one person that is A, B, C, or D. And that's okay to participate in. You're like, oh, okay, I've got somebody who is vegetarian. Mm-hmm. So let's make sure something on the menu is substantial enough in addition to everything else that they'll feel inclusive.
For sure, mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, all of the recipes on the shiksa.com are kosher. So, but that's not to say it's a kosher Jewish website only. I really approach food from a world perspective. I like putting together all kinds of flavors from different parts of the world. And so, you know, the recipes are kosher so that, you know, anybody who keeps a kosher diet or halal can mm-hmm. enjoy them. But really, there's something there for everybody. So.
Very cool. Now, where can people find you?
They can find me on theshiksa.com.
Okay. How do you spell that?
S-H-I-K-S-A.
Thank you.
Theshiksa.com.
Okay.
And then also thehistorykitchen.com. And they're actually connected, the two sites. So if you find one, you'll find the other.
Okay.
And the Shiksa Market is connected to both of them as well. So if you're interested in any of the products, they're there.
Thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Come back soon.
I will.
We'll eat cupcakes together.
This
Tori
fun.
Abey, of course, the Shiksa in the Kitchen. Up next, Bob Klein, Community Grains. We'll talk with him about, well, about Community Grains and Olivetto. All that ahead on Dining Around. Mm-hmm.